Hello and welcome to Digital Exposed. I'm your host, Sarah Farrell, and in this, the very first episode of a brand new season, we're kicking things off by asking a question which is high on the socioeconomic agenda right now. Has the cost of living crisis killed the focus on sustainability? 2023 and beyond are pivotal years ahead for sustainable action, and the concerns raised by scientists just a couple of years ago are now very much a reality. We all have been challenged to play our part in living more sustainably. But with the cost of living crisis continuing to squeeze shoppers' pockets and utility and business costs significantly increasing, is it financially possible for sustainability to continue to be a priority for both shoppers and brands? In this episode, Digital Exposed is joined by a very special panel of guests. This expert panel will be sharing thoughts and perspectives on global sustainability and how the cost of living landscape is impacted. They'll provide important insights into what really matters to shoppers right now and actions the global FMCG industry can take to help strategize and succeed over the cost of living versus sustainability battle. Firstly, I was joined by Nicole Corbett, who's the Vice President of Global Thought Leadership at NIQ. She set the scene for us and talked us through some eye-opening information, including the part new government mandates play, extreme climate events, impacting goods and supply chains, and the many things now considered by shoppers to inform decisions. She also told us how to prepare as brand or retailer for what lies ahead.
Thanks very much, Sarah, and thank you very much, everyone, for joining us today. So I think if we take a step back and we really look at what we're here to talk about today, fundamentally, sustainability is going to be one of the biggest changes that's going to affect business in the next 3 to 5 years. It's going to change the way that companies do business today. And with that, we're looking at what are the three key drivers of this disruptive change that we really think is going to spur that momentum. The first that we really want to be looking at here is the role of governance and mandates. And we believe that governments and legislators, or we can see around the world, are at very different stages in setting hard frameworks to adhere and signal various incentives, fines, or penalties as they try to make great headway in driving sustainability initiatives across the world. The onus will start to be coming more from business, will be put onto businesses rather than consumers to drive that change. At the same time, the second major disruptive change that we're really looking at is extreme weather events themselves. So I think, you know, across, we can all be testament across Europe in the summer of 2022, the extreme droughts here in Australia where I sit, the floods that we had in 2022, all are having creating exploding costs, which are coming as a result of extreme weather events. Those events are having an impact on rising cost of goods. We're seeing disruptive crises like the Ukraine, obviously rising energy prices, spurring that shift to renewables, and obviously the extreme weather events impacting supply chains throughout the world as a result of the scarcity that we see as a result of crop failures, etc. And of course, we have the last area that we'll focus on today is that ongoing and escalating consumer demand. Something we've been tracking at Nielsen IQ over the last, you know, 5 to 7 years. But I think, you know, we're really starting to see that momentum shift in the last 12 months or so. So if we have a think about the governance and legislation, we really believe that this is one of the critical components that is really fundamentally changing the movement behind sustainability across 2023. What we're starting to see, and we're just using Europe as an example here, because the European Union is becoming increasingly active with a pipeline of stricter and stricter regulations, and we can see that more and more are coming. Often, and this is where we're, you know, seeing again across markets around the world, we're starting to see, you know, more simpler, I suppose, legislation or requirements come through, be that of disclosure or, you know, the report sustainable reporting of what companies are currently doing today. But as time progresses, and we'll already see examples of this happening in Europe with the deforestation regulation, for example, that came in late last year, we're starting to see that those requirements are going to get stricter and stricter as they start to impact which products will be able to be traded and sold under which conditions. And that overarching element that is going to be required is that full transparency in products and their supply chains across the board. One of the key things, which is obviously governments are starting, and James will speak to this a little bit later, is, you know, obviously having a really close scrutiny of the claims that companies are making. And that's going to be continued to be scrutinised and challenged, obviously by governments and legislators, but also by consumers themselves. In our survey that we did at the end of last year, we saw that 77% of consumers around the world are saying that they would be likely to stop buying a brand if it was found guilty of greenwashing. So it's a huge wake up, I think, to companies that as we move forward, that we will start to see you can't just throw, you know, a green or an eco-friendly claim on a pack any longer. It is going to be necessary and required that you can back up those claims with transparent and authentic data that sits behind it. The other significant driver behind sustainability momentum is really the true financial impact that climate change is having on companies' existing business models. Just as an example, if we have a look at the map, we can see the huge number of extreme weather events that impacted crops and production across the world. So the last 2 years have proven that with globalization of supply chains, they suddenly become very vulnerable. The way products are sourced, produced, and sold can no longer be relied on when there is disruption by these extreme weather events, which obviously tip the status quo and create great scarcity in our globalized supply chains. Floods, fires, and droughts have all had a massive impact on agriculture. And this is obviously contributing to the cost of living crisis that we see today due to the scarcity of ingredients where companies just can't readily replace those as a result. And this has meant that companies can no longer rely on those traditional sources of origin. So it's becoming more the cost of not doing anything means that we need to start looking at risk mitigation to say, what is the cost if we don't do anything at all, if we suddenly are not able to get the supply that we need? The third element is obviously that escalating consumer demand. And I think in today's economic environment and, you know, around the world, so many markets are feeling inflationary pressures, it comes as no big surprise that when we ask consumers what's most important to them when they choose a brand, that affordability and lower prices is one of the number one criteria that they're choosing. I think, you know, from our perspective, though, if you have a look down that list, health and hygiene obviously come in, you know, very closely there on the back of the pandemic over the last couple of years. But sustainability or environmentally friendly options that consumers say that they're looking is, you know, equal third place along with trusted and familiar. Why? When we start to look at that, you know, obviously we can see that consumers are putting more importance on that as a variable to them in their lives. So we can see that 69% of consumers are saying that it is more important, sustainability is more important to them than it was 2 years ago. And, you know, that's coming off a base of today of over 90% where consumers are saying they rate sustainability as important to them. Why is it becoming important to them? Again, I think, you know, if we think of our own lives, we're seeing sustainable, you know, news about extreme weather events and the importance of our action. We're seeing it in the news all the time. Our level of information is that we're having access to is obviously growing. But I think also interesting, it's that personal impact that we're starting to see, whether our own health and safety is potentially at risk as a result of climate change. You know, in many developing markets and not so developing, we see, you know, pollution and waste all around us as well. And I think, you know, coming back to that whole cost of living scenario as well, one of the key reasons we can see that 35% of our consumers globally are saying that they've noticed that things have become more expensive because of climate events. And lastly, again, whilst obviously lower down the list, but if you actually think of the realities of that, 1 in 3 people are saying that they've been personally impacted by an extreme weather event in recent times. So when you start to feel it as a consumer or as a person, it's impacting your hip pocket in terms of the prices that you're paying when you go into store. You're battling with insurance companies to see, you know, increased premiums, what you can do or how long it takes after an extreme weather event that I can attest to personally last year. You can start to feel that change is needed and consumers are starting to act, you know, and making those choices as a result of that. When we ask consumers what are the different actions that they're currently taking in their lives, we can see for many, they're doing a lot, you know, a lot of actions that they're already starting to do. 49% of consumers, you know, are taking their own or reusable bags when they're shopping. Some of these in certain markets around the world are obviously already being triggered by legislation like we spoke of at the beginning. Here in Australia, for example, it's now mandated that, you know, there's no longer single-use shopping bags are allowed in any of our major retailers. So as a result, consumer behaviour has had to adapt as a result of that. But interestingly, I think when we think about the theme of our session today, you can see those items that only buying what people need so that they're avoiding waste, minimising electricity usage, eating leftovers. Some of those things are all about, you know, making things more cost effective for consumer in their lives as well. So there's that double bonus or that compromise that is sometimes happening is, yes, I want to make better choices for the planet. And if that can save me money, you know, that's obviously going to be a greater incentive as well. The reality is, though, whilst consumers are trying to make some, you know, big changes in their lives, there's a number of barriers that they perceive are stopping them from being more sustainable. Number one on that list is just that they perceive sustainable options currently are just too expensive for them to fit into their daily baskets. 41% of people saying that they're too expensive. The next areas really come around to availability and choice. 35% saying the biggest barrier is that there's limited product availability or range of choices when they go looking for sustainable options. Another 1 in 4 find that when they go to buy, it's confusing or that information is unclear or not even available on pack. So it's difficult for them to make that choice. So again, these are the things that we need to start addressing, and we'll obviously come on to talk with Alison James about some of the things that brands and retailers can do to address these barriers that consumers are highlighting to us. Because at the end of the day, I think all of us appreciate that it's not us, it's not a brand or a retailer or governments that can do this in isolation. It is obviously a shared responsibility and a collaborative approach that we need to tackle from many, many angles. But when we ask consumers, which groups do they perceive to be most responsible for making progress on sustainability in their local markets, consumers are holding brands to account almost the most, with 46% of consumers saying that they believe brands, you know, should be responsible for making the most progress. This is closely followed by local government at 39%, and then obviously consumers recognising the impact that they or the role that they play in this game as well. So again, I think it's important as brands and, you know, obviously retail as well, the role that they can take in collaboration with brands is how we need to come together to the party to try and make some seismic jumps as we go through. Because consumers are asking for help from retailers and brands to help them be more sustainable in their daily lives. So when we put to them, what are some of the options that you think, you know, brands and retailers can do? From a retailer point of view, it still very much seems to be focused on the sort of the here and now in terms of reduced plastic and compostable alternatives when it comes to packaging. Obviously, also really pulling on that key barrier around price, whereas retailers could help, you know, introduce or increase the range of cheaper sustainable options for consumers, be that more value brands that offer a sustainable alternative or their own private labels that they can take responsibility for. Linked to price is also obviously being able to reward consumers for making better choices, be that through their own loyalty schemes or reward programs that they can give back once consumers, you know, showcase that they're willing to purchase in that way. From a brand point of view, as we said before, you know, it's really making sure that a sustainable option is set at a comparable price to other products. And we'll come on to talk about this in a little bit more detail later. But as more and more legislation comes in, which is mandating brands and companies to make changes to, you know, ensure that their products are sustainable, I think it's going to be a lot more difficult for brands to get away with that price premium that they may have been able to have in the past as a way of using sustainability as a way to differentiate themselves. But the other key area that I know, you know, Alice will definitely come on to speak to is making sure that our labelling and the information that we're providing to consumers is easy to understand so they can see that, that you know, the actual credentials or the transparency in the information that they're after to make sure that they're actually making the right choice and it's founded in sustainable principles and not brainwashing, as we were talking about before. At the end of the day, if we look to see what the future of sustainability is going to look like, that journey we know is very long and very complicated. It's very easy for us to say, flick a switch, switch to renewables, reduce your packaging. But just in internal discussions before this session, we know how complicated that process can be. But we know also that there are a number of existing solutions that are already available and could be readily adopted and spread. Things like, you know, looking at alternative packaging to reduce plastic. Obviously, just looking at what claims we're making on our packaging today and removing anything that we can't unsubstantiate, because if we don't do it now, regulation is going to require us to do it later or soon before we know it. The next step might be things sort of in the next few years that we need to start thinking about now, but they will require additional development and investment time. But if we don't start thinking now, we can't be ready to flick that switch when we'll need to. And that might be investing in things like sensors, for example, or the technology that's going to enable the data collection to sit behind all of these requirements that we're going to need to prove and showcase to meet the regulation that comes forward. And then, you know, moving down, you know, to 2030 and beyond, fundamentally, sometimes these things are going to require seismic shifts in the way our current business model operates today. And they're going to have to replace existing practices that we do. So we may have to source from, you know, completely different ingredients from completely different areas that we do as a result of extreme weather events. You know, we may not be able to buy our coffee where we used to, for example, before. But also, you know, looking at alternative ingredients as well. All of those things are going to take time, but it's a matter of putting those plans, those goals and those targets in place now to see how can we be ready to embrace that change that is coming. Because we know there's going to be things that will fast track or enable us. There's going to be a number of enablers that will really make that transition or help proactive companies to embrace that change quicker. Things like technology advances is obviously going to help the transition. The necessity just to comply with new legislation will mean that, you know, companies need to say we have to do this now. Otherwise, you know, we'll be fined as a result of it. There's also, you know, the whole concept of adapting to more sustainable business models due to the spiraling costs that are actually happening under our existing models today. So all of those things will spur more immediate action. For others, though, they're going to wait, I suppose, or less progressive companies, you know, they're going to continue to think that the barriers are too high. We'll wait for a better technology. We'll wait till the costs come down low. But what we truly believe is that those who continue to wait and to lag, it will very quickly catch up to them, particularly as legislation starts to come in. And they'll start to see that, well, you just can't trade with the EU anymore, for example, if we can't meet the requirements for, you know, products coming into that, that huge market. So it's a wake up, not just for European companies, but for all markets across the world who want to trade in those areas. And as we know, often a lead market, you know, something will happen and we quickly see that roll out across other markets, like the sugar tax, for example, that started a number of years ago and now, you know, prevalent across many, many markets around the world. So I'm now going to open it up or hand it back to Sarah. So that was a very brief overview of our topic. And as Sarah said up front, we have a whole wealth of materials available on our sustainability hub that she will share in the chat for you to peruse at your leisure.
That's great. Thank you. Thanks so much, Nicole. There's a lot of important information there for us all to digest. So as I mentioned earlier, we are being joined now by our other panellists today to continue the conversation. Just to recap, we've got James Peach, who, as I mentioned earlier, is our regulatory specialist at Nielsen IQ Brand Bank, and also Alice Rackley, who's the CEO at Polytag. So James, Alice, Nicole, thank you for joining us. I'd like to dig a little deeper to start with. I'd like to dig deeper with all of you, actually, into some of the topics raised today, just to get your take on some of the critical points which have been raised and how best we can embrace them, what advice you have, and the key actions we can take to stay ahead of the changes. So I'm going to kick off the session by asking the key question: has the cost of living crisis killed the focus on sustainability? So I'm going to start with you, Alice.
Thanks, Sarah. And Nicole, thanks for the presentation. It was excellent. To answer your question and the title of the presentation today, no, sustainability is not a fad. It's not going to be killed off just by a blip in the road, as it were, this cost of living crisis that we're currently all tackling, although it's challenging, of course. I believe that sustainability is a commercial imperative. And there are all sorts of pressures. Nicole's just covered some of them off in the presentation today that mean that, you know, brands and retailers are absolutely going to have to continue on this journey towards achieving sustainability. So I don't accept that a small, in the relative scheme of things anyway, a small cost of living crisis is going to prevent that trajectory towards a more sustainable way of consuming product to change. So.
James, what's your take on this?
Yeah, I think that's right. And there is also, you know, the aspect that it depends on the premise of the question a little, doesn't it? So on any objective view of it, I mean, listen to what Nicole was saying earlier about the governance and the regulations coming in. There's certainly no diminishing of focus from the authorities in sustainability at all. In the UK, you've got the Competition and Markets Authority with the Green Claims Code, which is, you know, now out there for businesses to use. And they announced in January this year a project aimed at understanding the environmental claims being made on a whole range of FMCG products. So, you know, they're very actively looking at this. And in the EU, we have the Sustainable EU Food Systems Initiative. The consultation results published last September. We can touch on some of those later. This all moves apace with the authorities. But I mentioned that, you know, it does kind of depend on the premise of the question, because I think obviously in a cost of living crisis, it would be fair to expect there will be some impact on consumer approach to sustainability. And this is where, you know, brands are going to have to, you know, step up and take the measures to address this. And there are things they can do. We can go through some of these today. Because at the end of the day, you know, it's human nature that's at play here, isn't it? You know, in normal times, never mind in a cost of living crisis, people not looking to spend more than they need to spend. And, you know, I've been given calls quite a lot recently to think of some quite useful research that was done and alluded to by a senior member of DEFRA at a different event I attended a while ago on it was country of origin labeling, where, you know, itself a sustainability measure, which, you know, goes to food miles and carbon footprints. And that research showed that, you know, whilst it features as a high priority with consumers on the way into the store, then actually when they come out, you know, looking at the sort of the decisions that drove their purchasing behavior, it perhaps because of cost pressures, typically it's more expensive to buy local or has been, then it kind of falls down on the priority list. And that's just, you know, in normal times, as I say, human nature. And, you know, in a cost of living crisis, it's about now getting those key messages across, especially on sustainability. If you've got strong sustainability messages, you've got to think about how you can do that in order to offset the increasing headwinds that we're all seeing here. So the opportunities are there, though. I think, as Nicole mentioned earlier, around 35% was it, of consumers are linking inflationary pressures and cost increases to these environmental factors that we're seeing. So, you know, there's a motivation there. So, you know, there is an opportunity to seize, definitely.
Yeah. Nicole, would you agree here?
Yeah, look, totally. And I think it's not so much a one or the other, but, you know, it's a matter of coexisting between the two things, definitely, you know, going to continue in the short term. You know, inflation's not going away in the short term. And I think as we showed up front in terms of how consumers are purchasing or thinking about a brand, affordability is number one. But I think, as we said, it will all come down to the prices and, you know, the price premiums that sustainable options have been able to get away with in the past. And maybe they just can't get away with that premium, you know, as we move forward, you know, be it because of legislation or be it because of consumer demand. So I think we will see that premium will no longer be acceptable to consumers.
Just
to build on that, I think the other thing that's probably going to happen, and we're already seeing it to an extent, is that those products that are not sustainable will actually have taxes applied to them punitive, fees applied. And now we'll see a sort of levelling up, actually, in terms of price architecture on the high street.
Do you think regulation would help? Do you think harmonised, perhaps even mandatory label scheme could be a leveller in the industry? Do you think it might help to address the price premium for sustainable products?
I can only talk about one in particular example, which I think is really interesting, and it's still yet to be sort of fully understood in terms of how it's going to unfold. But the plastic packaging tax was introduced in April last year and sees a fine of £200 a tonne or a tax of £200 a tonne applied to any plastic material put onto the market that doesn't contain at least 30% recycled content. And so, you know, any brand that's sort of shifting PET plastic without that 30% recycled content in it is going to have a cost applied through this plastic packaging tax, which will no doubt flow through at some point to the consumer. We're coming up now, April this year, for 1 year, the first full year of this plastic packaging tax being in action. It'd be really interesting to see what happens and whether or not those products that are not sustainable have this increase in cost applied to them through tax and punitive fees.
I think as well, just to we've talked, haven't we, Alice, about, you know, nudge policies versus anything with more teeth, and the plastics tax is a really good one, where, you know, we're businesses are effectively being nudged. They don't necessarily have to. They'll be penalised financially for not doing so. Versus, you know, other, and there's lots of things in sustainability and in health and wellness sort of sectors as well at the moment, other schemes and regulations that put direct compliance obligations on businesses in order to nudge consumers and consumer behaviour, HFSS, out-of-home calories, DRS, these kind of things. So I think at some point, someone somewhere, and I'm sure there will be people in government doing this, need to sort of stand back and sort of do an assessment of which ones are working there, which produce the best results, you know, to get to where we ultimately want to be. Because, it's hard to know sometimes which are the most effective routes.
Do you think regulation would help, Nicole?
I think when you specifically were talking about labelling, I think it comes down to the information that sits behind that label and who's providing it and who's verifying it. Because if it's up to companies or brands themselves to say, yes, this is what we're doing, or this is the burn, and they're not being held to account, I think, you know, that's where we get the issues of greenwashing if we can't, you know, we can't back up those claims. But if we've got third-party verifiable sources that is going through to double check that they're meeting the requirements that the label is stipulating. You know, there's trials across a number of countries in Europe with the Planet Score labelling that initiated in France, which is very specific, and, you know, an independent, you know, third-party database that is, you know, weighing up those claims and giving that that traffic light score against it. So I think it all comes back to having that transparency and a third party to certify the claims that are being made on label.
Yeah,
I think as well, from the EU perspective, you know, one of the things that's really driving the activity there from the EU authorities is this notion of multiple schemes that might cause a, you know, confusing and fragmented landscape. You know, one thing the EU does not like is fragmentation. It's all about harmonization wherever possible. Sometimes mutual recognition gets there, but these kind of things, it's about harmonized rules and level playing fields, etc. And you know, the sustainable food systems initiative that I talked about earlier in the, and the consultation response that's published in September highlighted over 90% of EU citizens responded saying they were concerned that too many labels might be confusing for consumers. Yeah. That's going to resonate with the EU. And the upshot of all of that is that we're expecting quarter three this year announcements from the Commission around a number of matters on this particular initiative, but also, you know, the potential announcement that there may be some kind of mandatory harmonized sustainable labeling scheme.
I think it's inevitable that that's the way it will go. I mean, one of the points that Nicole raised on her slide about barriers was that there's lack of consistent standards being applied on all sorts of fronts. And you can put as many WYSI logos as you like and traffic light systems together as you want, but if the data sitting behind those labels is not consistently applied across an industry, then it's just all nonsense. Yeah, and you know, Polytag, we're an approved GS1 partner and we are absolutely fanatical about standards. We believe that applying consistent standards is what will enable sustainable economies to function correctly, because they bring this transparency to what everybody is delivering to market, allow you to benchmark accurately, and ultimately hold people account to the law. You know, if you don't have a consistent reporting mechanism in the background, then you know, much of what makes people work towards sustainability is just broken, can't function.
Yeah, I think any harmonised labeling scheme is going to have a harmonized methodology behind it. It's not just about the communication, which is a big piece. You know, there's a lot of work goes into how best to communicate to consumers what resonates, but the bit underneath it, the full life cycle assessment methodology, perhaps, you know, there, and that will be a difficult thing to, I'm sure, to get agreement at scale on. It will be necessary for it to work.
But I mean, the fact is, identifying sustainable products is really often really difficult for shoppers. What do you think brands and retailers could do to improve that shopper experience? Nicole?
Well, I think, you know, as Alice just reminded us, you know, in our study that we saw, you know, lack of information, unclear or just missing information, as well as not having enough choice of which products to choose from, are two of the three top barriers for consumers. So labelling is going to be critical, and, you know, not just traffic lights or things, but actually that transparency in what goes on behind that product. And, you know, whether it is a QR code on the pack where you can see, you know, more information, you can see the lifestyle, but all of that comes back with, you know, some of those things we spoke on in that, in one of those final slides on that whole journey. We need to be capturing that information in our supply chains ourselves. So, you know, investing in sensors and technology, because you can't put hand on heart and say, I know, you know, where my palm oils come from, or I know where that plastic has come from, if you're not tracking it yourself, or your suppliers or your producers are not tracking that. So I think there's some big decisions, big investment, and, you know, a lot of collaboration that's needed before we can even be starting to put these claims on packs, because ultimately I think it's going to be the onus on companies to say that, yes, I can provide this validated information, and if I can't, you're just not going to be able to make that claim, or you'll get automatically red on the traffic light if you can't prove that you should be orange or green.
Yeah. What's your thoughts on that, James?
So, you know, in terms of improving the shopper experience, specifically in the online space, there's lots brands and retailers can do. They need to be thinking about how they can drive the intent to purchase by making that customer's digital shopping experience more inspiring and more engaging. So for customers already looking to make a sustainable purchase, of course, it's about making sure the information they're expecting is available and engaging. And for those shoppers for whom sustainable purchases may not be their intention, it's about inspiring them to want to do so, right? And stopping that consumer from leaving your site, of course, and finding the information elsewhere. So you can do this by using enhanced product content to really cut through and, you know, make your sustainability or any other kind of messaging resonate with shoppers. And if you consider that 25% of shoppers are more likely to purchase when enhanced product data is used, that's a pretty big deal in the cost of living crisis, isn't it? You know, where brands are having to work harder to find the opportunities to win custom. So, what is enhanced product content? So, video is a great one. I can share some really interesting stats on the impact of video. 95% of a message is retained when a viewer watches a video versus only 10% when reading that same message. And people spend on average 2.5 times longer on a product display page carrying video content. And shoppers will consistently, over 90%, say video is helpful in the decision-making process. So that's one form of enhanced content, enriched content, video. And if you've got a strong sustainability message, it's a great medium, obviously, to be using to cut through and get your messages across. And then there's, you know, using more images. So people take in visual information much more easily than wading through text alone. Yeah. So having more product images improves engagement and conversion. Typically, one product image will equate to something like 8.5% add to basket rate, whereas four images raises that to 19%.
Yeah,
it's simple stuff, but it's worth, you know, just making the point. And then you can do things like interactive product tours as another form of rich content. So, you know, helping your brand to really stand out with sustainable messages. So you could have, you know, multiple images that contain hotspots that can be used to call out key features using text, images, and video. Or 360 spins. This is about, you know, trying to sort of really make the online experience as tangible as possible, almost like you're in the store itself. You can almost pick that product up and have a look around it. Again, it's a way of, you know, really sort of drilling down into, you know, those key messages that you want to stand out and offering the opportunity for the consumer to find them.
And I think with more and more people shopping online, and, you know, that statistic's going to increase, you know, as going forward. So, you know, I think that's really important. It's really important that you are able to give people as much of an in-store experience as possible. That's great.
Yeah, that's right. And it's, you know, for those that really do have, you know, a real sort of committed sustainability sort of ethic, you know, you can add FAQs and documentation that can really allow them to drill down into, you know, some of that specific information they may be looking for around key elements of the full life cycle, perhaps of their product, etc. And one of the bonuses, of course, of using increased rich content is that it drives better SEO performance, search engine optimization, making your products more discoverable. It's great having great content, but they need to be discoverable. People need to be able to find those products. And adding video, for example, to your content can result in that content being up to 50 times more likely to rank higher on a Google search. So, yeah, brands have got to ask themselves, you know, have they got the right data attributes to support SEO? Are customers going to find your product? And is my content, you know, a rich and engaging enough experience to really, you know, drive that conversion?
And it's servicing all the right attributes as well, isn't it? Making sure, you know, the health of your content is at a premium at all times. You know, as you said before, encouraging discoverability. Also, you know, brands, retailers, most people would land from a search engine, that were chosen search engine, on directly onto a product description page as well, not necessarily onto your homepage. So it's, you know, once you've got a customer on that page, you need to keep them there. You know, so like you said before, they're going to have all the information they need to inform a purchase. They're not going to go to a competitive website to find that information and ultimately buy the product from them as well. Nobody wants that.
That's right. And the final piece of the puzzle, I guess, is, you know, having a good handle on the completeness of their content. You know, a way in which to measure how they stack up. You know, compared to, you know, other products and their content that are out there, how does it perform? So you need a way to actually sort of gauge, you know, the health of your content health.
Yeah.
So to the original question, using these tools, you know, and enhanced rich content is a great way to enable shoppers to identify sustainable products and improve their shopper experience.
Yeah. And if I just build on what James has said, I think the next step is to then leverage all of that rich content that you've already got online and let customers access it through the side of pack, you know, off the label via a QR code. And, you know, as I said earlier, we're really big supporters of GS1 standards. GS1 are predicting that by 2027, all the Stripey barcodes will have begun to transition to QR code barcodes.
Yeah.
So still contain a barcode number, but allow you to link consumers through to barcode specific web content. And so, you know, you've got this opportunity which opens up where you're not restricted by your label size in terms of what you can share with the customer in print. You can just create an endless label, and the Polytag solution that we offer to brands that Ocado most recently have been in the news using allows brands to fully customize a landing page. So they can share whatever content they like with consumers. Ocado chose to have a different landing page every single week, explaining sustainability criteria of their products, and we're able to do that directly with consumers through the mobile device that they have in their pocket. Everybody yeah. has one now, and so yeah, if you've gone to the trouble of creating all this rich content and have it online, then why not also allow customers to access it directly from the label via a QR code?
Yeah, and I think, you know, we've got some, I think, Nielsen IQ statistics saying that by 2040, I think it's 85% of people will be shopping on a mobile device, or, you know, as opposed to, so all of this, you know, we need to be future-proof in our businesses, our brands and our businesses, definitely. So do you think, can sustainable options sustain a price premium for this foreseeable future, Nicole? What do you think?
I think in the short term, you know, generally we have seen sustainable options, you know, being at, you know, on average that 10 to 20% dearer than the average category product. But I think the more, you know, that we hear about greenwashing, consumers are becoming a lot more skeptical. So brands need to really be able to back up that value, or, you know, differentiate themselves as to why they can justify that price premium. And I think with that justification, it can't just be, you know, some of the throwaway green lines that companies might have been able to get away with in the past. Yeah. However, in the very short, you know, to medium term, as the legislation comes in, as fines and, you know, requirements are going to come, it's going to be the new level playing field where all options basically are going to have a sustainability, you know, a big part will be a sustainable message or a sustainable product that's there. So, you know, the premium sustainability won't be the thing that adds the value. It'll need to be a different differentiator to be able yeah. to justify premium pricing.
And what do you think brands can do to communicate sustainability benefits of products to shoppers and be a bit clearer on the value add? Alice?
Yeah, so I just go back again to saying that, you know, rather than restricting yourself to telling your sustainability story on print on your label, take it into the mobile space. Allow customers to look at videos on landing pages, allow customers to actually interact with your brand. You know, you can do surveys. Ocado actually ran a very successful survey over 12 weeks. And have collected some really interesting insight because they're able to have that conversation with customers through their mobile device that was triggered off the QR code on the side of pack. There's an enormous amount of collateral out there where brands are able to tell their sustainability story through video content, etc. And yeah, I think we're going to see a real big shift into this digital realm and allowing customers to directly access that information through mobile. I think the other interesting thing that we'll start to see, going back to this point about standardization, Polytag's all driven off a global data model that captures standard packaging attributes. So, you know, we're basically trying to get a consistency in the way that packaging is described. And we've aligned our database with the work that's happening at Open Data Manchester and with GS1. So again, like fully subscribe to a standardized way of capturing attributes. Yeah. And in our world, that's all about the packaging. We can surface that digitally for consumers on these landing pages so that every single product can be linked through this QR code, where customers can see what type of packaging actually is this and what should I do to dispose of it in the right way. So there's some really interesting future builds in terms of like being consistent and allowing customers to get access to that really standardized information to act on it and to be informed and to be educated.
Yeah. So how do you think consumers can be rewarded for making more sustainable choices, Nicole?
Look, I think, you know, there's so many. We look around the world and we look at the sophistication of retailer loyalty programs, for example. You know, to Alice's point, you know, currently we're capturing every, you know, those retailers capture every barcode that goes through at the register. They know when a sustainable choice is being made. You know, I think, you know, is an easy option to link those two together. And again, one of the ways that consumers are asking, you know, of how retailers can help them is to reward them through incentives for making choices. You know, sorry.
No, I was just agreeing with you.
Yeah. And I think, you know, there's other schemes that are out there. Again, here in Australia, you know, we've got a Containers for Change scheme that's been around for some time, slowly rolled out across, now available in almost all states, where you get 10 cents back, you know, for example, with every can or every bottle. And it's making those things easy for consumers. And again, different trials are going on, which, you know, I'm personally have been involved with, where, you know, they're coming to your home, they're picking up, you know, boxes and collection, and they're giving you a voucher then as a reward for that, directly right. paid to you, which you then go to your retailer, you know, and it's $10 off your next shop, you know, or however many cans or bottles that you've given back. So that, again, that type of collaboration, you know, across different areas, I think can make a massive change, and consumers will really benefit from that. And anything that's coming off their grocery bill in this, you know, inflationary environment is going to be greatly appreciated by the consumer.
And James, how do you think consumers can be rewarded?
So from a regulatory point of view, we see it with things like DRS and DRS Scotland, and depending on where that goes, you may be familiar with the headlines that have come out just in the recent sort of 48 hours. There will be some form of DRS UK-wide or devolved, I'm sure, at some point. And, you know, it's this notion of incentivizing the consumer to, I don't know if reward as opposed to be reimbursed but, you know, giving them an incentive to do the right thing. And I think the way that the kind of circular nature of the deposits work in those schemes is that the only people that are penalized are those that wouldn't return the bottle. You know, you have a PET plastic drinks bottle and you just discard it in a inappropriate waste stream, that you're the person that's going to lose out. So, you know, there's two sides of the same coin. There's the small amount of punitive measures there, but also the reward for going back to take it back.
Yeah, I don't know, Alice, you've got lots to say about this.
Yeah, I mean, those listeners that are familiar with Polytag will know that we're actually specialised in serialised QR codes. So yes, we can provide you with a QR code for each barcode that you can link through to web content and build a landing page. But in particular, Polytag's been developed to allow brands to also apply a unique every time QR code onto every single instance of their label. So that's to say that yes, it contains the barcode number, but it also contains a serial number, a unique number. Every single piece of packaging is uniquely identified. And the reason that Polytag has developed that is because of deposit return schemes, which will be hopefully digitized at some point in the future. Belgium have just announced that they're going to deliver a digital deposit return scheme. And in order to pay out deposits through the power of consumers' mobile devices, you need to have a unique identifier per piece of packaging. Otherwise, it's wide open to fraud. Otherwise somebody can scan the exact same stripy barcode 20 times and claim 20 times the deposit. And this addition of a serial number, which Polytag can provide for brands, is the key to delivering fraud-proof and theft-proof deposit return schemes. But it's got a bigger impact than that. And we're already seeing and working with other apps that are operating outside of an official government deposit return scheme to reward consumers. So those people watching the webinar today may have heard of Bauer. They're a big recycling app that's taken off in the Nordics. And there are other recycling apps such as Scrap and Trover, Horizon. And all of these apps are working on the principle of, if you can reward consumers for good recycling behavior, and you can do it in a way that is protected against this fraudulent activity, you can be more generous. And Bauer have just started working with us on all of the serialized QR codes we're putting onto the market with the likes of Ocado and Co-op, and are really excited about the fact that they can now scan serialized QR code and can therefore be more generous with the rewards that they're offering, because they are safe and assured that this is the only piece of packaging with this unique serial number on it. So there's some really interesting future activity that we're going to see coming our way, both government led and also just digital solutions innovating to reward customers. But I think that there's going to be a big shift towards consumers being able to be rewarded really easily, really efficiently through digital technology. And that will incentivize more sustainable, not just more sustainable choices in the shops, but also more sustainable behaviors post-consumption in how they handle packaging. Yeah, I could talk all day about it, but I think it's really exciting what we're going to start seeing in terms of consumers being rewarded for.
It's really exciting, yeah. And so I'm sort of conscious.
Sorry, Sarah, can I make one?
Yeah, of course you can, Nicole. Yeah,
outside of the recycling realm as well, though, which is obviously important. But you know, the way consumers are shopping today, there's a lot more refills in store that you know consumers are able to choose from versus the traditional plastic bottles, etc. But I think you know brands have an onus to make sure when they're looking at their pricing and promotional strategies that they're making refills, you know, an attractive option for consumers to choose, you know, rather than saying, okay, I've got a 50% promo on my traditional plastic bottle and my refill still sits at a 20% premium. Consumers are clever enough now to be doing the sums and working out the per mil, or it's even on many countries' shelf tag to say what the price per mil or per gram is. So I think it's up to brands to start saying, if you're putting a sustainable alternative out there, make sure it is appealing and it is priced, you know, priced accordingly or promoted accordingly to make that a better choice and reward consumers in that way.
Yeah, and I think we've spoken a lot today. It's been brilliant. I've really enjoyed the conversation. We've spoken a lot about how to communicate sustainability and the information required, but it's really just the start of the journey. So how can companies get ahead of what's to come? What would be your advice? So I'm going to start with James, I think, on this one.
Okay, so I think increasingly, whether it's a harmonised EU scheme, whether it's you know complying with the Green Claims Code in the UK, if you're not already thinking about the full life cycle assessment of your products, you need to start thinking about it and having an understanding of all the aspects that go into the production of your product. You can look at the publications from the CMA on you know guiding businesses as to what that really means. You know, there's been some pushback from businesses about, well, do I really need to know the full life cycle assessment for every single type of claim that I could possibly make? And the response, generally speaking, of a paraphrase, is that how can you know you're not being misleading if you don't know everything about how your product is made, is essentially the point. So you're going to need to know this. And of course, once you know this kind of information, then it's about how you communicate the key points that you want to call out that you say are the good sustainability narratives about your products. And it's the diverse, rich content aspects that we were talking about earlier, the videos, the extra images, you know, the 360 spins, the product tours, all FAQs, all these other things that you can add to your online digital product record, which are going to make it stand out and inspire that consumer to buy your product, whether it's someone that's looking for that to start with or somebody that may not know they're looking for that but is just, you know, given that little bit of a nudge to think, you know, this is a better purchase than that one over there. Because, you know, as we mentioned earlier, some of the stats on conversions that follow from simply having that better content are just worth the effort. And you're going to have to get on top of this LCA stuff. So, you know, surface it in useful ways.
Nicole?
I think, you know, to back up what James is saying on life cycle assessment, I think, you know, it's not a matter anymore of brands to say, do I want to be sustainable or, you know, is it a choice if I'm going to have an offering in that area? I think it is going to be a requirement if you want to do business, you know, going forward. So the big thing is to say, how am I going to transform my business in those ways? And starting now is obviously the key thing. Start to plan. What are some of the easy wins? As we said, when we looked at those horizons, what are the easy wins I can do now? sign up to more, you know, renewable energy as a part of your power supply. Start looking at ways you can reduce plastic or food waste, and then obviously starting investing in sensors, in technology, because all of those things will be able to give that full transparency that's just going to be a requirement for your business moving forward.
Yeah, and really quickly, Alice, what's your take?
Yeah, it was a great slide Nicole shared earlier that said, you know, who are consumers looking to drive this change? And most consumers were calling out brands themselves and the government. But I think it's actually incumbent on tech companies such as Polytag to build the solutions that are going to actually enable this transition towards sustainability, and for brands to join us and learn alongside us and collaborate in order to really step change. You know, we say at Polytag, stop guessing and start knowing where your packaging is getting disposed of and where it's being recycled. And you can only do that if you adopt new technologies. And you know, Polytag's here, we're ready. We want to work with these brands that are serious and committed to doing the right thing on a sustainability front. And, get in touch. But I do think that it's actually the tech companies that are going to be instrumental in driving and making this change land.
So that's it for this week. Thanks to all our listeners. It's been a pleasure, as always, to have you with us. For further information on all the NIQ Brand Bank Intelligent content and product performance solution discussed in this episode, this is all now available on the link to this podcast, which you can find on your usual podcast streaming sites and also on our website, www.nielseniq.com. As always, please feel free to like the podcast and to share this content via your usual social media platforms, and we'll see you next time.